This is John Rappaport, and this is my pre-recorded piece for the November event. I want to thank Catherine and everybody else involved for their work in bringing this to fruition. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be quite fantastic. All right, so I want to start at a place where I have started before, and that is the creation of reality. The creation of reality for us by others. And I've used several metaphors for this in the past. It's a mural, it's a stage play, it's a movie, and we are looking at it because elites, aka secret societies, have determined for a very long time, in fact, you could take this back to the dawn of history on this planet, these elites have decided that the way to operate the game called planet Earth is to present reality to the audience, to the masses. Television is really only the latest form of that. But always the strategy has been the same. If we don't show them what reality is, they might decide what it is for themselves, and that could be highly dangerous to us who are in charge. We could be talking about government in smaller groups, just little tin pot leaders, the priest class, whoever is in charge at the top of the power ladder. No, we can't have people deciding on their own what reality is all about. We have to present it to them. And we do this in various guises, in various ways. We can have a theocratic community or a theocratic state. We can have a state where there is a king who claims that he has some sort of divine right to rule. But whatever the explanation, it's all in the service of we present reality to the audience, to the people, to the masses, and they buy it. We sell it, they buy it. That is considered to be absolutely necessary strategy by elites because, again, they're terrified of the idea of decentralization of power. Suppose we had our audience consisted of 100,000 people and there were 37 different versions of reality floating around out there, basic reality. How horrible would that be? We would no longer have power. We would no longer have monolithic control. Even worse, much worse, suppose for each of those 100,000 people, there was his or her own basic reality. That would be a catastrophe, an absolute catastrophe. And so they paint this dire possibility as utter chaos, things spinning out of control, no one in charge, no rules, no laws, no standards of behavior. So with this false presentation, they then move on to say, therefore, we have to cut out the competition. We have to be the ones who present reality. And that's the way it has always been, and that's the way it is now. So, my favorite metaphor for this is the mural. It was the first one that I used, and I think it's still the best because I tend to favor painting metaphors. So let's imagine that we're looking at a 5,000 foot mural on a gigantic wall. And that is reality for the masses. And they're all looking at the wall. This, by the way, has an historical precedent in Plato's Republic and the famous cave image, where the people are sitting in a cave looking at the wall, where they see shadows cast by the sun and by objects which actually exist somewhere in a perfect ideal form, but the people can only see the shadows, and they take this to be reality. And Plato muses on the idea of people eventually turning around and walking out of the cave into the sun, where they would finally see things as they are, meaning in their perfected form. However, Plato painted himself into a corner because he presumed that everything already existed in some idealized nature. And since only a few, relatively few people could perceive this, once again, those people would have to be in charge. They would have to be the philosopher kings. They would have to be the rulers, because everyone else would be blind. So they would have to, the rulers, pass down laws, rules, the shape of society in order to keep things in some sort of order. Because after all, they were able to perceive perfection, but nobody else was. And that was one of the gigantic major flaws in Plato's treatise on, on government, the Republic, which has been pointed out many times by scholars, but there are other scholars on the other side of that who say, no, he was absolutely right. And this really is the way that a republic, which would be a catastrophic misnomer in this case, should be formed, on the basis of those who really know. What I'm saying is something quite different. The mural, which gives the masses reality, is being created for them by the elite. And this elite does not care one whit, really, about the substance of the mural. It could be painted 1,000 different ways. The thing that's important is whatever is there is perceived by the masses as being what is real. Okay, to move along here, there are two possibilities. One is that the masses, we the people, see this mural which depicts reality and describes it and shows it in its finished form, or we could see it as it is being painted by the painters standing there on ladders, on scaffolds, etc., with their brushes and paints and so forth. The mural is meant to be utterly convincing, in the sense that when people look at it, they not only accept it as being reality, but they say to themselves, this could not be any other way. Reality could not be other than what we see here. That's the point of the whole thing. Not just, well, this is interesting, and now I will walk out of this room in the museum into other rooms that have other paintings. No, 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 no. This is not that kind of setup. This is a museum with one room and one mural only. And that has to be the way it is. So, if we can only look at it in its finished form, then we are subject to being taken in. Perhaps not completely taken in. Perhaps we can say, well, look at this little piece over here. I don't know if I really believe that's real. And look at this other piece up on the, you see that up on the left side? I don't know about that. That doesn't convince me that it is reality. But by and large, I guess, you know, this is the way things are and the only way they could be. There would be that tendency, if we were only able to look at the mural called reality in its finished form, because it's meant to be so overpowering and convincing and final. But, if we were able to see it in progress as the painters are working on it, then that would be a whole different situation. Oh, look at what he's doing there. You see how he draws those lines and he paints in this block next to that block, giving the illusion of perfect perspective. Oh, yeah, when I look at that, it seems, well, quite real. But now that I see how he's doing it, and that face over there, see how he's, oh, yeah, this is very interesting. Now that I'm watching the painters at work constructing this gigantic mural, of course, I'm not at all convinced that this is reality, because I can see it as it's happening, in progress. And that was my motivation many years ago when I began to have the opportunity to speak to the people that I call insiders who defected, the most notable of which was Ellis Medavoy, a pseudonym for a retired propaganda operative, a real master in the art of propaganda, who was involved in major operations on behalf of various elites to convince the populace of the planet through media that certain things were the way they were, when in fact they were not the way they were at all. In other words, through Ellis and his very extensive descriptions beyond anything that I had ever heard about propaganda and how it really operates and the principles on which it's based, through listening and talking with Ellis, I began to see the mural in progress, the painters working on it, and other insiders were made available to me. And so the bulk of my work after that point was really about showing people reality construction. You know, I would sometimes call this the reality construction company. And through various means and analyses of operations, covert operations, and gigantic propaganda campaigns, to reveal the nuts and bolts, the inner workings of these operations in progress, so that people would have a much different view, a much different opportunity to see all of this in action, so to speak. And why is this so important? Because it gives us hope. It gives us real hope and optimism and a view of what's possible based upon watching the painters, the artists at work. Because the more we see how the mural is created in process for us as a perverse work of art, the more we begin to infer and understand that we too have the capacity to create our own mural. It's contagious, in other words. Oh, that's how they're doing it. Oh, look at what they're doing over there. And now look at what they're doing over there. And this is how they're doing it. Oh, this is much different. It's unfolding in front of me. Oh, this is a work of art. Perverse art, to be sure, but art. This is imagination and creation in action. I'm beginning to get the idea that I too can do this. I can create my own reality. Instead of, oh, it's all horrible, it's all finished, the mural is done, reality is here, the powers that be are overwhelming, they continue to coerce us into believing in the mural of reality. They have just immense resources at their disposal. They run the system. There is no way to get out of it. We're trapped. What can we do? There's no solution. You know, all of this kind of processing and thinking and concluding on our part is really a precise function of viewing the mural of reality as a finished product, whereas when we see it in progress, we are now thinking along different lines and the function is changed dramatically. And to go back to another one of my metaphors, the stage play. You see, you go into a theater and you watch a play, and there is this principle that is such a favorite of critics and historians of the theater, which is the suspension of disbelief, the idea that the audience, once they're there and they sit down, they would ordinarily not believe what's going on because they know they're in the audience and they know there's a stage and they know these are actors saying lines, but something causes them to suspend that disbelief, or to say they now believe in what they are seeing for the amount of time that they're sitting in the theater. Yes, indeedy. They are believing. But because they are seeing the play not as a finished frozen tableau, but something that moves through time and takes place from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock, and they see the story unfolding and the characters revealed and so on and so forth, they understand that this is a work of art. It takes place across time. And some of those people will walk out of the theater and think to themselves, that was a production called reality for 2 hours. These were actors. They played parts. They were very convincing. I saw it unfold. Therefore, maybe, my life is a kind of stage play that I am acting in, directing, and so on and so forth. And if that were the case, then it could be changed. It could be changed. What a thought. Maybe I could stage a different play. It's all about art. It's all about imagination. It's all about invention. It's all about creation. It's all about those things. So, to the degree that we can understand the mural of reality and history, a series of murals of reality, as process, as dynamic unfolding, as the moment-to-moment creation of a work of art meant to show us what reality is, then we can infer and feel in our gut and in our brain and our emotions the distinct possibility that we, in groups or basically and finally we as individuals, can make our own work of art, which is the reality that we prefer, the reality that we want, the reality that we desire. Now, of course, when one has been subjected for a very long time to an elite mural of reality, there is a tendency to forget what one as an individual actually desires and wants at the most profound level. And amnesia tends to develop around that. And so that needs to be rediscovered. It needs to be dug up. It needs to be found. It needs to be contemplated. Because if I'm going to now produce my own work of art, my own reality, you know, I don't want to do this in just a casual, superficial way and toss it off. This is now going to be big. This is now going to be major. This is now going to be major in the sense that it partners with some profound desire that I have about what I truly want to be my reality, my future. What is that? What is that? To what do I want to devote and dedicate that much time, effort, energy, and imagination in order to have the existence that I'm looking for? To frame this discussion another way, let's call the mural of reality the status quo. The status quo, which seems to be everywhere and at all times, such a successful covert operation that it infiltrates and bleeds into every aspect of life. The way things are, the status quo, the status quo, the status quo. Where is the lever that you can use to lift yourself out of the status quo? And the answer to that is one idea. One idea. You get an idea. You walk around it. You look at it. You rub up against it. You dive into it. You come out the other side. You consider it. You shape it. You frame it. You change it. You develop it. Your idea. An idea about what reality actually is, apart from the mural, apart from the status quo. Your idea about what you truly want your reality to be. One idea. And you rise above the status quo. That's what it takes. That's the beginning. That lets you know that the mural, the status quo, is not final. Never was. Always an illusion from the beginning of time. Always an illusion. So this mural, what does it show? Well, it shows political realities and social realities and realities about war and peace and money and finance and military, intelligence, energy, medical, relationships among people, psychology, purported psychology, biology, chemistry, the works, end to end, you see, meant to be final. And just to give you one example, if you look at psychiatry and its associated fields of so-called research, neurological research, brain research in particular, that part of the mural intends to convince people that the center and the seat of all life is the brain and its processes. And by better understanding of the brain, we will be able to control to a highly significant degree the life of the individual. Control it, change it, quote, make it better, quote, make it more happy, quote, make it more free from, quote, disorders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it all comes back to the study of the brain and its processes, its chemistry, its biology, its electrical aspects, and so on and so forth. Very convincing to many people, extremely, extraordinarily convincing, despite the anomalies and inconsistencies and logical contradictions of the implications of focusing on the brain as the seat of all life. And I've covered this in many articles and presentations. I'm not going to go through it again here. But that's just one piece of what we see in the reality mural, because the whole purpose of that mural is to nail down what existence is, what reality is, you see. And so, whereas some people will doubt perhaps one area of the mural, they'll go to another area and they won't doubt it at all. And as a matter of fact, such as the brain, in not doubting that at all, in enlisting in the church of the brain, that really overcomes any doubts they might have about other parts of the mural. So that's one way in which this fabric, this mural of reality, operates. Yes, it's understood that some people will have a problem accepting certain aspects of the one and only final reality, but that will be compensated for because they accept other aspects, and in accepting those other aspects, they are really on board. They're really, really, really on board with limitation, severe limitation on the possibilities of what the individual can create, invent, imagine, bring into existence in the world. So that's how it works. That's how it operates. Now, it's more sophisticated than that, in the sense that in order for a picture of reality to be universally accepted, it has to plug into certain pieces of the apparatus of you. How you perceive, how you think, how you feel. If the reality mural were so remote from how you think, perceive, and feel, then you would merely look at it as a curio, a curiosity, a strange thing. Well, look at that. It's kind of weird. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know who did that, but seems like they were bent on convincing people that this thing was all there is. Yeah, but I mean, that's ridiculous. And I know that because I can think, perceive, and feel in ways that have nothing to do with that, you see. Okay, so that's a problem for the reality manufacturing company. So they want to study you, and they have been studying you and me and everybody else since the dawn of time. That's part of the deal. That's part of the nuts and bolts of mind control, population control, and so on and so forth. Studying, well, how do people react? On what basis do they react? How do they think? How do they feel? How can we plug into that so that our mural of reality will be a wondrous thing to them that locks into the way they think, perceive, feel? That's part of the show. That's part of the deal. And of course, we can see in contemporary brain research that this is very, very, very much on the minds of people who are doing the research at DARPA, for example, the Pentagon Technology Branch and the National Institutes of Health and other facilities around the world. How can we map the brain in real time? How can we see exactly what it's doing moment to moment? Not just so that we can plant thoughts in the brain. We want to understand the totality of perceiving, thinking, feeling of the human being so that we can construct better and better versions of the mural using more and more advanced technology as we go along to create this lock and key situation. That is vital to understand. That's what they've always been trying to do. See? They look at you and they say, you contemporary and you historical, you know. And they say, well, let's see. This is the way he thinks. This is what he feels. This is what he wants. This is what he sees. Okay, so we have to do lock and key there. We want to provide something that is going to fit, just like certain chemicals land on certain receptors in the body. That's what they're trying to accomplish. But you see, and this is one of the reasons why I have been so monomaniacal on the subject of imagination for all these years, and in my work with the brilliant and late hypnotherapist Jack True, was so involved in this particular study. Imagination has, among other things, biological and chemical consequences and effects. Effects on hormone levels, effects on patterns that can be observed in the brain, effects on the range of emotions that one can experience in the sense of widening that range. And I base this on certain, limited to be sure, because nobody is funding this work, but limited experiments with Jack True, clients of his who were all too eager to participate in this, and on my work with my own clients over the years, especially in the area of expanding the spectrum of feelings and emotions beyond those which we have labels for and which we are all too familiar with. I have talked about this in the past, but I haven't really given it its full due. So in the next few minutes, I will try to expand on this a bit. Those who create reality for us want to reduce the number of emotions that we can experience as much as possible. Well, naturally, they would. let's see, we like to do fear, grief, and anger, if we could do that. Let's call it the outrage, frightened complex, you know, whatever, they give names to this sort of thing. They want to make this as Pavlovian a process as possible, because the fewer the kinds of feelings you can feel, the more prone you are to being controlled. The easier it is to construct this lock and key situation. This is what mind control is about. This is something as esoteric as you might think it is. It's not esoteric at all. There are people working on this day and night. Believe me. Pavlov is their hero. The drooling dog is our symbol of the greatest thing that can be accomplished for mankind, you know. Ring the bell, the dog drools. This is the future, my friends, and I am the dictator of the bell. This is what they want. Everything that happens in our educational system, in the workplace, this is all tuned up to reducing the number of acceptable emotions that a human being is permitted to feel. Whereas the truth of the matter is that the range of possible emotions and emotional sensations that one can feel is without limit, without limit. Consider it an infinite spectrum for which we, on our best days, only have a few labels for, you know, the words that name or describe feelings. Okay, let's see, maybe we've got 23, or is it 37, or 86, or 42, whatever it is, that's what we've got. That's what we consider is the range of human feeling, and so on and so forth, and that is absurd, and the absurdity is shown when one is living through and by imagination and creating his or her own reality in line with his or her most profound desires. All of a sudden, feeling emotion goes light years beyond what we thought it could embrace. And the lock and the key situation that they would like to use to entrain us is impossible to impose. I mean, ridiculously and forever impossible. Because instead of reducing and reducing and reducing down to a few little, you know, possible permitted feelings, we're going the other way. Really going the other way. Imagination, the visioning, envisioning of that which you truly want in all of its dimensions is a catalyst for opening up the range of potential emotion and perception and thought beyond anything that previously exists in your memory of your own life and your own existence. It expands, 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 expands. And then the status quo begins to look like something smaller and smaller and smaller. The idea, the one idea that I mentioned that you need to rise above the status quo, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 12, 150. And then life on this planet does not any longer look locked down. Not at all. You see the program to lock down life on this planet, but you do not see life on this planet as locked down. It is that creative aspect of us which brings us to the vision of what we truly want, gives us the opportunity to make a commitment to that vision, that spells the difference between ordinary life and extraordinary life. That's the deal. That's the deal. And the reason that the philosophers, for all their enormous contributions in certain areas of life, have missed the boat by just, you know, galaxies, because for them the creative aspect of life was not something that they wanted to understand fully or comment upon. Because if they did, they would have to acknowledge that what they, the philosophers, were striving for, which was a final representation, cosmological, metaphysical, what have you, was only provisional, because every human being has the enormous capacity to imagine and create his own metaphysics, cosmology, reality, which would decentralize all of philosophy, all of psychology, all eventually of biology, into unique representations in which each individual is primary, 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 primary. Okay. Now, I want to give you a few imagination exercises to do. I'll describe them. To some, they will seem strange. To others, they'll seem, you know, like, what? He wants me to do what? That now. Yes. Yes. It's exactly what I want you to do. Now, I've developed hundreds of these. I'm just going to give you a few. And the purpose is just so you get a flavor of what can happen if for 15 minutes a day, every single day, for the next 6 months, you do these exercises. That's what I'm talking about. Oh, well, I tried it at night before I fell asleep last Saturday for about 8 seconds while I had the television on and I was eating, and nothing really happened, so there's nothing to this. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Every day, 15 minutes, 6 months. The first one is a modification of an exercise that I gave on a seminar I did called Mind Control, Mind Freedom. And this is what you do. You stand someplace or you walk someplace. Doesn't matter where. Could be in your house. Could be outside. And you project with your imagination, eyes open, something that you like. Could be anything. Something you like, though, onto the environment, by which I mean the sidewalk, the trees, the window, the wall, a house, a building, a car, a person, an airplane, a train, the sky, clouds, planets beyond the clouds, galaxies beyond the planet, a dry cleaner's truck going by. You project something that you like in profusion, you know, like boom, 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 right? So I've had people say, well, how can I do that? How is that possible? Well, it's possible because you have an imagination. Well, I'm not sure how that works exactly. So then I would say, well, fake it. What do you mean fake it? Well, pretend you have an imagination. Imagine that you have an imagination. Imagine that you can project, which is really the same thing, to let you in on a secret. Okay, so you want me to say, for example, take a walk and something that I like, which would be something like, I don't know, I like fruit. I like peaches, plums, grapes. I love that. Oh, yeah, perfect. Just start projecting peaches, plums, and grapes on everything around you, on cars, on people, on houses, buildings, street corners, you know, the FBI headquarters, whatever. Or if you're in your house, project it on the carpet, on the desk, on the ceiling, on the telephone, on the lamp, on your kids, on the refrigerator, on the stove, you know, the ceiling. Just keep projecting, pow, pow, pow. Keep projecting that. Yeah, just do that. And if you can't do that, pretend you can do that. And then that's exactly the same thing. And just do that for a few minutes. You know, 3, 4, 5 minutes. Just keep on doing it. And somebody will say, well, why should I do that? No, just do it, and then you'll understand why eventually if you do it every day for a few minutes or 6 months. This is a workout for your imagination. Instead of saying, build greater muscles, order these weights for your home now, this is, do an imagination exercise. Just, you know, loosen things up. Your imagination might have been sitting there in a dusty basement for a long time, and now all of a sudden, hey, the phone just rang. Oh, he wants me to do some projecting. Okay, great. Whew, wow. Boy, how long has it been since I've been just sitting here in the dust? Okay, let's go. So that's one exercise. Okay? Here's another exercise. Another crazy exercise. You stand in a room and you lean against the wall with two hands. You push against the wall with two hands. And you project into the wall various colors, red, blue, green, black, orange, whatever colors you want to. You push, you project the color. You project it into the wall, and then you project it, you know, as you begin to, oh yeah, red. You begin to project it into the wall, through the wall, out the other side of the wall, through the house, out of the house. Change the colors any way you want to. Now I'm projecting red, now blue, now green, as I'm pushing against the wall. The combination of physical and imagination at the same time. Just another workout for your imagination. As you can see, these two exercises have no particular, partisan political basis. They don't specifically relate to the one great vision that you will have of your own reality and that you will then commit yourself to. They're just a workout for the imagination, because as the imagination becomes more powerful and has a wider range and you have more confidence in it and you enjoy it more, you know, oh, God forbid that you should actually enjoy this, but you do. Why not? As you enjoy this more and more, this imagination is a pretty fun time. I really like this. Yeah. Well, then that becomes a kind of contagion. You see, you're now infected with a disease of imagination. There's no drugs for it. There's no vaccines. There's no doctors. There's no treatment. There's no downside. It's all upside. And familiarizing yourself with the effects of your own imagination. Nobody else's. This is not a group thing. You do it by yourself. You see, oh yeah, I guess I can imagine this. Wow. It's, and when I do, I like it. I mean, I like the feedback. Yeah, wow. Who would have thunk it? You begin to have more interest in and respect for your own imagination, and you begin to see that you have more power. There's more power in this thing called imagination than you might have supposed. Well, I was doing this for 3 weeks every day, and then sometime in the fourth week, I don't know, something happened. I was just pushing the color red into the wall, and all of a sudden, I got this sense of, how can I describe it? Power. And it wasn't a bad thing. It was a great thing. It was real. I was really actually putting that color into the wall. Something that I had imagined was now actually having an effect, so to speak, on interacting with the physical world. Not just as an intellectual possibility. I really experienced it. I felt it. Wow. And I went around thinking about that for a while. And I don't know. Lately, I've been feeling more confident. Yeah, that's right. You would. Confidence is directly connected to imagination. Here's another exercise for you. Now, this one is a little, some people would say this is a little more vague. If you find it to be more vague and nothing will change that, then just stop doing it. But for those who find it useful, it can be very useful. You take a walk, you walk down the street, and you sort of look at the space where you are. You know, everybody's got a little bit of different space. What are you seeing? You're seeing, I don't know, if you live in the city, you're seeing the street, some buildings, cars, people, but it's within a certain kind of area, you know, depending on your focus. It could be a radius of 4 or 5 feet, or it could be 10 feet or 30 feet or 60 feet or 100 feet. I don't know, right? Whatever it is, space. You're perceiving space. And people tend to perceive space in habitual ways. Not all the time, but generally the kind of amount of space that they're perceiving around them tends to be, you know, similar from day to day. So change that as you're walking down the street. Look at bigger space, perceive larger space. Just look further around you, right? And then larger, further, perceive bigger space. And now take in some of the sky at the same time you're taking in the street. More space, okay? And now, on top of that, begin to imagine more space. After you kind of reached what seems like the farthest extent of what you can perceive as space, begin to imagine more space. Well, the space of the rest of the city as you're walking down the street. But you don't want to do this so you end up bumping into people or you are crossing at a light, okay? You've got to stay safe here, okay? But somewhere where there's no problem in that regard, as you're looking and perceiving the space around you, begin to extend and expand that by imagining greater and greater space. I've had people say, yeah, well, I was walking down this country road and eventually I was perceiving slash and imagining space that went out all the way to, you know, Andromeda. How did it feel? Fantastic. Got the sense of bigger and bigger space, possibility. It's like how the painter will say, well, I was doing paintings 2 feet by 2 feet, but then, you know, one day I walked into a museum and I saw this big painting and I went home and I stretched a canvas that was 20 feet by 15 and wow, whew, did things change after that? So your vision of what you truly want has a connection to space. Yes, indeedy it does. So what would happen, perhaps, if you were cognizant of and imagining larger and larger space? Well, your vision of what you truly want might get bigger and bigger and bigger. Very important. Very important. Because think of it this way. If a person's space, that they perceive and can conceive is pretty much a constant, and it's pretty small, then their vision of what they truly want will tend to be small. And therefore, their commitment will be small, and what they will actually do in their life and achieve is going to be small. Well, okay, I'm not, you know, severely putting down small, but I'm saying you can go the other way. You really can. And that's an exercise that might have some spillover there. So do that for a few minutes every day. So I've given you three here, and let's say you're doing each one of these for roughly 5 minutes, and that's 15 minutes a day, every day, 6 months, see what happens. See what happens. These are introductory exercises that have to do with imagination. They get you into the ballpark, the ticket that gets you into the ballpark. Okay. Now, if you want one more, a different kind of exercise, this is a writing exercise, you would do this separately, and you would do it for as brief or an extended amount of time as you wanted to on a daily basis. You would write at the top of a page or type at the top of a page, what I would never want to do in my life. What I would never want to do in my life. Okay? And you would begin to write about that. And sometimes you would write brief phrases, and then sometimes you might write an essay or a page or three paragraphs on how much I really would never want to do X, whatever that would be, you know. Sell candy in the park. Never going to happen, you see. This is all what I would never want to do in my life. And the reason that I give this to you in the negative form is because it is going to tap into your imagination. Let's see, what would I never want to do in my life? I don't know, this, that, okay, this, that. You run into a few of these things, maybe a dozen or so, and then, gee, I don't know, what else would I never want to do in my life? Well, I would never want to try to walk into the ocean with a gigantic kind of container that was a mile wide and scoop up all the water and bring it back to land and dry it out and take all the salt and put it into bags and sell it in Siberia. Right. That's imagination operating. It may be facetious and crazy. So what? Why can't it be amusing? Is there a law against that? You begin to invent all sorts of things that you would never want to do in your life. It's a workout for imagination. And I'll close on this. Some people, when they do this exercise, spontaneously, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, after who knows how many times doing it, an idea pops up out of the hopper and they start to move past it and they go, wait a minute. Maybe that's a thing I would want to do. And they begin to think about that, and they stop the exercise, and they begin writing about that. And 10 or 15 pages later, they're on fire. Because out of the hopper of things I would never want to do in my life, which they're imagining, all of a sudden, something comes up that was hidden there in the imagination, something they truly, really want to do that they had forgotten all about or never entertained before, and now it's real. It's so real, in fact, that it could change their life. It could become their vision, their commitment, and what they do for the next 30 years. I've seen it happen. Okay, I wanted to give you a few exercises so that you could get into this and see what it's like. Have fun with it. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. See what it brings you. As for the reality mural, when all is said and done, that's all it is. A mural. One work of art out of an unlimited number of possible works of art. And perverse elites and their artists have decided that everybody should salute, bow down to that particular mural. Imagination tells us not going to happen, absurd to even consider that it should happen. Forget it. Forget it. Forget it. Forget it. So to get back to one of the little exercises that I gave you, the one that involves projecting things that you like onto the environment. This could be anything you like. You like gemstones. You like beautiful paintings. You like the sound of music, the sensation of eating whatever it is you like to eat, the feeling of contentment. A word that you like, truth, beauty, whatever it might be. With your imagination, you project something you like onto the environment. I once worked with a private client who was an architect who had stopped designing buildings for various reasons. Some of which had to do with the fact that he had great difficulty in getting commissions to do the kind of work he wanted to do. And so he was in a long-term funk. And I gave him some of these exercises to do, including the projection exercise and some others. And at first he said, well, I don't see what this has to do with my situation, et cetera, et cetera. I said, well, just try it, see what happens. So he did these exercises every day for 3 weeks. And at the end, he said to me, I get it. I get it. I said, well, what do you get? He said, I get the idea of projection, projecting. That's what I was doing as an architect. I was projecting my vision into my drawings for buildings. And then I stopped projecting. He said, I had reasons for stopping, but underneath it all, that's what I did. I stopped projecting my vision into the world. Well, I couldn't have thought of a better summary myself for what happens to many people. And doing these exercises reminded him and gave him back that fundamental, basic, natural as breathing air faculty of human beings, which is to project. It brought it all back to him. And consequently, his career was rejuvenated. And he began to develop strategies for actually being able to design the buildings that he wanted to, because he had now experienced that ebb. You know, what happened when he stopped projecting? He had been through that whole experience of being rejected and being pushed off to the side, and his naivete was gone. He was much more seasoned at that point. and realized that the world was not what he thought it was exactly, and that he would have to be much more intelligent, much more circumspect, and much more powerful as well, in order to make his visions come true. But none of that rejuvenation would have happened if he hadn't clicked back into this faculty that he and everybody else possesses, which is the ability to project a vision into the world. Project, project. So that's what that exercise does for you. It brings back eventually the fact that with your imagination, you can project onto and into the world. Okay. Now, at the very beginning here, I brought up the fact that it is far different for you to be able to see the process of the making of the mural of reality than it is to see the finished product when it is put in place and you are looking at what the perverse artists have done to sell you the, quote, one and only reality. And I wanted to give you an example of that from my own experience, and I've talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into it in great detail. But it involves my work as a reporter in tracking so-called epidemics starting in 1987 with HIV and AIDS and moving through to West Nile, bird flu, SARS, swine flu, and now Ebola. In 1987, when I was beginning to write my first book, AIDS, Inc., I had no idea what I was getting into. I knew as a reporter by instinct that there was something very strange about the story, the mural that was being sold to the public, but I didn't know the details. And after consulting with a number of people, each of whom had his own explanation for what AIDS actually was, I came upon the jackpot at the end of the rainbow, which was, and I can't attribute this to one person, there were several who demonstrated to me beyond a shadow of a doubt that the researchers in charge of the AIDS problem, who came up with the virus HIV as the cause, had never proved that HIV caused AIDS. It wasn't even close. They hadn't come within light years of proving it, even by conventional medical standards of what you need to have in order to show that a certain germ causes a disease. And I went over their work, and because I had a good, strong background in logic, I was able to understand their thinking. It wasn't really very complicated at all. And I went back to the research papers of Robert Gallo and Luc Montagnier and those who had purported to prove that HIV caused AIDS. And I saw all of the flaws jumping out at me. So I found myself in what for me as a reporter was an unprecedented situation. That everything the establishment media and everything the government was telling people was false down to its core. This was not like a political lie or social lie or even an economic lie, for me anyway. This was much more shocking. They never proved the virus had anything to do with AIDS. It got even worse than that, because after I published my first book in 1988, at some point I became aware of the work of what's called the Perth Group in Australia. Several scientists who asserted that no one had ever proved that HIV even existed. And I found their work quite convincing as well. And I also noticed that perhaps with one rare exception over the years, no one in establishment science was willing to debate them or even answer their questions, which to me is always a tip-off. So, first of all, this is the kind of isolation that many people talk about. What happens if I know the truth, but, quote, nobody else does, and I feel that I'm on the outside looking in, way outside looking in, how do I connect with other people? And the answer to that, of course, is you state your position in some way. You know, you create a platform upon which you can state your position. But at an even more fundamental level, what we're talking about is to end the sense or feeling of isolation you project. You project, because the sense of isolation is really the feeling that you cannot project. And in this case, what we would be talking about is truthful information. That is a very vital thing to keep in mind. So I projected. I wrote my first book, and it was published, and it got out there, and it still gets out there. I still get emails from people 26 years later about the book. I projected. It doesn't have to be a book, of course. This can take any form. So, once I had seen that HIV was never proven to cause AIDS, and that there was a strong likelihood that it did not even exist, as preposterous as that might sound to people who hold a conventional view, when I read press releases from the CDC, this would be going back, you know, 1987, 88, and moving forward, press releases from the National Institutes of Health, from AIDS researchers, when I read newspaper articles about HIV and AIDS, and AIDS in Africa, and AIDS in gay men in New York, and AIDS in Haiti, and in IV drug users, and so on and so forth, hemophiliacs. Now I began to see the process by which the mural was being painted day by day. I had a place. I had an informational place, you might say, on which to stand, from which I could view the actual painting of the mural in process. That was an extraordinary awakening for me as a reporter and as a human being. So when these other so-called epidemics came along, I found many similarities to what I had discovered with AIDS and HIV. The stories weren't always precisely the same, but there were many features that were the same, many basic features, and I won't try to enumerate all of them. Again, though, it was watching the mural in progress being painted. The narrative, if you want to put it that way, being created. And of course, I began to see the purpose of all of this, and many purposes. I mean, this is a multi-layered, multi-level operation that has motives at different levels. All major covert operations have levels. They seek to achieve more than one aim. So over the years, I continued to project many articles and lectures and radio interviews and so on and so forth about these so-called epidemics every time one popped up. And essentially, I was saying to people, I'm watching the mural being painted, and this is what is really going on here. And it afforded me a look deep into the matrix as it was being produced, which was, to me, indispensable. And I would say that to you as well. In other words, become an investigator. I realize that not everyone is going to be interested in investigating to the same degree and extent that a reporter would who's trying to go behind the scenes. But if you pick an issue, some issue in which you are interested, and you begin to do deep enough research and find truthful information below the surface that contradicts the conventional view, the mural, and you track it through time, you track the progress of the mural as it is being painted by reading news stories and press releases and so forth, now that you know the truth, you will be looking at the painting of the mural in progress. You will see it. And that, again, is a much different experience than coming in later and saying, well, look at this. You know, you don't even see it as a mural at that point. You just see it as reality because the painters know how to do a good job. That is a wonderful experience for anybody. For example, I know people who have done this with money vis-a-vis the Federal Reserve. Oh, you know, they begin to get an idea. Well, maybe the creation of money and the control of money is not what we think it is. For example, I had a client who did this. And of course, the person to go to here is Catherine. I had a client who began to do this vis-a-vis the stock market, because he was an investor. And so he came to me and said, you know, I'm realizing that I'm just playing a fool's game here. Something is going on with the market that I'm not aware of. Things don't add up. I'm buying into information that is obviously misleading and false, and I'm basing my decisions on that. And, you know, I'm suffering as a result of it. And I'm trying to get better at what I'm doing. But really, what I'm seeing now is that I'm a typical gambler who's addicted and who's trying to make up for his losses by extraordinary moves that will recoup losses and book profits. And it's just not working. And you know, we talked, and I encouraged him to continue his investigation, because that's really what it was. And with that tag end from his own personal experience in the market, he began to research money and so forth. And, of course, he found a tremendous amount of information out there, which led him to the Federal Reserve and led him to manipulation of markets and so on and so forth. And once he had struck gold, informational gold. Of course, he got out of the market as an investor, but more important, as he described it to me, he said, I can see it now as it's happening. And what he meant, of course, was that he could tune in on, you know, the financial reports on television, listen to the pundits, read the newspaper stories, market goes up on, you know, this event and goes down on that. You know, he could just read financial news and instead of treating it as true or simply false, he saw it as the mural being painted in real time, day to day to day to day, because he had found deeper knowledge. And he was excited in a way that I had never seen him be excited before, because he was seeing the construction and invention of reality before his eyes as it was happening. He hadn't just fluffed it all off and said, oh, well, okay. No, he had continued to observe, to watch, to listen, to gather information. But this time, what he was gathering were the brushstrokes of the painters who were creating financial reality and money reality. And it stood him in good stead. As he said to me at one point, he said, I know this is true of many other areas besides the one that I'm investigating. I can see the parallels. So now I'm strengthening, the way he put it was, I'm strengthening my position outside the reality game by A, knowing truthful information that is deep and basic and important, and B, observing the propaganda, aka the painting of the mural, in real time as it continues, so that I am there, present, was the way he put it. I'm present at the birth, at the continued birth of reality. It strengthened, as he put it, his psychological position in his life, in the world, to do that. It gave him not depression, but optimism to do that. It wasn't horrendous and horrible. It was, in a strange way, uplifting, because he was now actually present at the birthing of reality, and therefore knew with greater and greater conviction that his position outside the reality game, as he put it, or outside the matrix, as I would put it, was indeed a position of strength and power, more and more and more. And then he began to project. He began to project his vision of what he wanted in his life, another whole story I won't go into. And it worked extremely well. It does work extremely well. Much more I could say and will, but there you have an opening salvo in how the reality game and the matrix connect with you and what you can do about it. What you can do about it. Okay. This is John Rappaport. Thanks very much. All who are connected with the November event, looking forward to it very, very much. See you later.